Commission on Metropolitan Government will come to order. This is our last meeting of the 2015 session that I'm aware of, and we are going to be electing a new chair. First, what I'd like to do is I'd like to go around the table and have all members and staff introduce themselves. And we'll start with Melissa.
I'm Senator Melissa Wicklund. I am represent Bloomington and part of Richfield.
Representative Michael Nelson, I represent Brooklyn Park.
Representative Jim Nash, I represent District 47A.
Senator Jim Carlson, I represent the district including Burnsville and Eagan, 51.
Representative Tony Albright, I represent Prior Lake, Jordan, and several of the townships in Scott County.
Representative Peggy Scott, I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and one precinct in Ramsey.
Amanda Tinsley, CA for Government Operations and Elections in the House.
Senator Eric Pratt, I represent Scott County.
Senator Dave Osmek, represent Chanhassen and the good half of Hennepin County.
Senator Brunbeck, represent 38A, and that includes northern suburbs, Circle Pines, Lionel Lake, Centerville, etc.
I'm State Senator Scott Dibble, and I represent a pretty good part of Hennepin County, too, and Senate District 61, Minneapolis, Southwest, South, and a little bit of downtown, and chair of the Transportation Committee.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm State Representative Frank Hornstein, and I'm the southern half of, the northern half of Senator Dibble's Senate District, which is parts of downtown and Southwest Minneapolis.
I'm Abby Loesch, and I am with House Republican Research.
Thank you. First thing we have on our agenda here is the approval of the minutes of the last meeting.
I would move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, motion's been made. Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The minutes are approved. Next is the election of the new chair of the 2016 session. And I believe, do we need to have a nomination, or do we have a nomination?
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Oh. Please. Go ahead.
That would be nice.
Go ahead.
I would like to nominate State Representative Tony Albright as our future chair.
Representative Albright has been nominated, and I believe, let's say, seconded.
I'll second it.
All right. Any other nominations? Any other nominations? Any other nominations? I believe what we have is by affirmation. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Representative Albright is now the chair.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Thank you for all attending today. The purpose of today's meeting, and I think at this point, I think just a good reminder of the responsibilities of this commission are warranted, and so I've asked staff to actually make a copy of the statute under which we find our responsibilities, and it's in your packet as well. The responsibilities that we have to the Met Council are to observe, recommend, and review their budget, and to make recommendations or observations to those committees and or the legislature and legislative leaders as we see fit in accordance with those responsibilities. And so today our responsibility is for the folks that you see at the testifiers table today to give us a review of their budget. The hour being 2:45, I would expect that that could be wrapped up in about half an hour. And then for the remainder of the time that we have during this committee meeting, that would be allowed for questions from the committee members pursuant to those items in the budget that we have questions about. So, Mr. Shetland, with that, welcome to the committee, and please announce your name and position for the committee, and then continue.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations on your new chairmanship. My name is Judd Shetland. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before the Commission again this year. Mary Bogie and I, Mary is our Chief Financial Officer at the Council, are prepared to provide an overview of our unified capital and operating budget levies. You may recall from an email I sent to the Commission late October, the Council is planning to adopt this budget next Wednesday afternoon at the Council meeting. So hopefully folks had a chance to review those materials that were sent at that time. But in the meantime, what we have prepared is a very similar presentation that we made nearly a year ago. It was December 5th last year when we were here before the commission and have taken the same approach with a similar type style of presentation that it's a broader overview. And if you have additional questions, we will do our best to answer them. But it may require some follow-up as well, and we're happy to do that. And, Mr. Chair, if there's other issues or concerns that you may have, we'd be happy to come back for future meetings to have those conversations as well. But when I spoke with Ms. Tinsley last Tuesday, the idea was to bring forward an overview of our budget, and that's what we prepared to do today. And, again, if you have any questions, we're happy to take them. But please keep in mind that it's just Ms. Bogie and I here today. And if there's a real heavy detail that you're looking for, we'll be happy to provide that to you as soon as possible. So,
very good.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank and you. If you don't mind, I'll turn it over to Ms. Bogie, and we'll get started.
Welcome, Ms. Bogie.
Thank you. Again, I'm Mary Bogie. I'm Chief Financial Officer for the Metropolitan Council.
And, Mr. Chair, let me add that Ms. Bogie has a very sore throat. So if it's hard to hear her, we will.
It'll hold up, and I will speak up.
Yeah. We have some lozenges up here to help you get through.
All right, so we're going to get started with an overview of the Council's 2016 unified budget and our proposed levies. I just thought we'd start with just a look at our statutory responsibilities, and they really fall into three categories. We have responsibility for planning, and that's the long-range comprehensive planning, regional transit planning, and regional parks. Operations, we operate a very large wastewater system, regional transit system, and our housing authority. And then also
Ms. Bogie, I'm just going to ask you if you could tip that microphone closer to you. Yes, that would be very.
Try to get a little closer as well. So then finally, we have grant making responsibility as well, and those grant making responsibilities come under the Livable Communities Act, and as well for regional parks and trails. I just thought I'd start with kind of an overview to kind of give you a scope of the kinds of services that we deliver and who's using those services. And we'll start with our metropolitan parks. We have more than 48 million visits to our regional parks over the last 2005 to 2014. Mm-hmm. That's an increase of about 15 million. So really big growth in the use of our regional parks. We have 54 parks that are parks reserves, covers about 55,000 acres and about 300 miles of interconnected trails. Our parks range from urban to suburban nature centers, a working farm, large tracts of rural open space. The parks are operated by 10 partnering cities, counties, special districts. We call them the parks implementing agencies. The council allocates state and regional funds for the ongoing land acquisition and development of the park system. This graph gives you a look at our regional parks capital funding proposed in our capital program. We're allocating about $290 million to the state parks. Those are state bonds. They're council bonds, so regional bonds, monies from the Environmental Trust Fund, and money from the land and legacy funds. On the clean water side, wastewater treatment is one of our core functions at the council. Day in and day out, our wastewater system, which includes 8 wastewater treatment centers and about 600 miles of pipes and interceptors, collects 250 million gallons. 175 million of that is at the Metro plant. We provide wastewater treatment to about 2.7 million residents in 108 communities in the Twin Cities region. Our wastewater treatment plants have near perfect compliance. 6 of our treatment plants have earned the National Association of Clean Water Agencies Platinum Peak Performance Award for 5 consecutive years, and 2 of those plants, Hastings and St. Croix, have over 20 years of perfect compliance.
And, Mr. Chair, if I can jump in real quick, it was in the mid-2000s that we actually had the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government take a tour of our wastewater plant, and we'd be happy to extend that same opportunity to the committee here as well. It's an enormous facility that really does function at the highest levels, and we're very proud of it, and it's one of those things that when we come to the legislature, since it is funded through the user through a user charge. We don't spend as much time talking about our wastewater utility, but it is certainly something that that we're very proud of and would love to take you and the committee and commission members on that tour as well. I know some folks have taken it, but it really is something to be seen. So consider yourself invited, and I can happily work with whoever to get something like that set up.
Mm-hmm. So while we maintain very high performance standards, we also have been able to do so with rates that are very competitive. And I think I showed this chart last year as well. And when I was here last year, I was noting that nationally rates have been increasing at over 5%, and NACWA really believes that they are going to continue to increase at over 5%. The council has been much lower than that, but we suspect that we will be coming much closer to that rate as well. For 2016, we have a proposed 5.4% increase. Some of the reasoning for that increase that we're seeing, and I talked about this last year as well, is just the aging infrastructure nationwide, some declining technical support, and increasing regulations. It takes an awful lot of infrastructure to reduce minuscule particles in the wastewater system. So those come at a very high cost. So just kind of a look across the nation of what we're seeing as the cost of clean water index. And this is a little bit dated information, but it's still very indicative of where we fall in comparison with both our region and across the nation. So across the nation, we see rates in the 400, 395, 368, 400, and here in Minnesota, 255.
And let me just add, it's important to include that in that average. That includes local government charges as well to that amount. So the council's is actually less than that, but your municipalities often will add a charge on top of that. So it just makes us even more competitive.
On this next slide, I wanted to throw in here just to talk a little bit about sustainability and talk about wastewater as moving kind of toward a one water look, because it's not just the wastewater we're treating, but what happens to that wastewater, or how we treat it, or how we conserve energy. These pictures on this slide represent some really good uses. So the first slide on the left there is the city of Waconia and Carver County partnered on a stormwater recapture. And so the stormwater is reused to water the ball fields, and it's pretreated water, so water that would have been potable water is now not being used, and instead this water is used to water the fields, and also for private parties can also connect into that source and use that water. So a really good sustainable water use. On the right side there, we have our East Bethel Reclaimed Water Distribution System, and this is our newest plant that we opened, and the distribution in this system helps replenish the aquifer in that area. And then on the bottom there, this is a look at our solar energy out at our Blue Lake plant. Our Environmental Services Division has been working really hard to reduce their energy consumption. As you can imagine, treating 250 million gallons of water takes a lot of energy, about $15 million a year. But since 2006, they have reduced their energy usage by about 21%. And our goal going into 2020 is to reduce it by 50%, and they're well on their way to doing so. And solar energy is one of the ways that we're attacking that.
I believe Senator Pratt joined us on a tour out there maybe a year ago, a year and a half ago, where we were talking about not just the wastewater features and the public-private partnership we have with New England Fertilizer, but we were just beginning to start to look at what we could do with our solar facility, because I'm sure, as you would know as well, Representative Albright, that is a very large facility right along the Minnesota River, mm-hmm. that we have lots and lots of room that was that we were able to go ahead with this project. We worked with Xcel Energy on that as well and bring forward this kind of solar garden that we think is going to be fantastic and allow us to operate that facility or as much as we can with that solar energy, again driving down the cost to the system. So we think that we're kind of on the maybe on the cutting edge of that, at least here in Minnesota.
This next slide talks about regional ridership, and in the region we provide about 300,000 rides per day. That's about 97 million rides in 2014. And as the pie chart shows, the bus system is really the driver of that ridership. About 83% of the ridership comes from the bus system.
And that's regional ridership as well. So
when I talk about regional ridership, I mean not only the Met Council and the services provided by Metro Transit, the bus regular route, Blue and Green Line, North Star, but also Metro Transportation Services, Metro Mobility, our contracted dial a ride, Metro Vanpool, but also the suburban transit providers, Maple Grove, Minnesota Valley Transit, Plymouth, and Southwest. So all of those contribute to the regional ridership numbers that I was talking about. Again, 2014, our ridership was $97.6 million. This slide shows you how that breaks out between Metro Transit bus, about 69% of those rides, rail about 17%, and other transit programs, suburban transit providers, Metro Mobility, contracted routes, about 14% of that ridership. For our 2016 budget, we are estimating over 100 million rides. Significant point to make is that most of our ridership comes from riders who are going to work and school. And this next slide just talks about some of those programs that we have to encourage that ridership. So the MetroPass is a program with participating employers. We have about 288 employers. About 47,000 MetroPasses are in use, and that equates to about 12 million rides. We also have a College Pass and a U-Pass. You can see the participating colleges and the University of Minnesota, about 6 to 7 million rides between those two programs. And then also we have a student pass with 48 participating high schools, about 3.5 million rides come from that source. This slide might be kind of hard to see on the screen, but it is showing the ridership that we have had on the Green Line, and it's pretty exciting ridership. The blue bars there represent what we went forward with when this project was put in place, and we were anticipating that we would reach 40,000 rides by 2030. As you can see by the charts, we exceeded those projections in 2014, and as of October 2015, we are well ahead of what we would have budgeted back then. And in the last month, 2 months, we've seen average ridership of more than 40,000. So very heavy use of that line. The A line is an arterial bus rapid transit service that will be opening in 2016 and running along Snelling Avenue. ABRT provides us a really unique service, much more frequent service, and much more enhanced service. So the bus stops look more like what you would see on the light rail line. There's much easier boarding into the system. There's enhanced maps and on-time, electronic on-time messaging at the station. So much faster trip, some signal priority. Really, really a neat service. Next, MetroSlide talks about housing. Our Metro HRA is the largest in the area. We serve about 6,500 households, and very effective and efficient service, as well as noticed by HUD's ranking. Yellow area on the map represents the area that the families that the council serves. I should also say that our Section 8 program uses existing private rental market and provides payments on behalf of the low-income renters to the private landlords. Participating property owners are guaranteed a stable source of rental income. Families can rent any type of housing as long as they're in that yellow service area. Eligible households pay about 30 to 40% of their incomes for rent, and the Metro HRA pays the remainder, and that comes from the federal HUD system.
And we generally have a very long list of folks waiting to be be able to get that rental assistance as well.
So those slides kind of give you kind of the scope of the council's responsibility and kind of the uses of our systems. We'll start then by talking about our operating budgets. So the council adopts both an annual operating budget and a capital program, including a six-year capital plan. This first slide represents our operating budget for 2016, and the proposed budget is $985 million. When we look at our operating budget, we kind of separate into three areas: our operations, our pass-through programs, and debt service. The council issues debt to support the capital program, and our debt service is repaid both from fees from the wastewater system as well as from our authority to issue a property tax levy. Pass-through programs are programs like the parks program, moving money through to the parks implementing agencies, about $30 million for the suburban transit providers is in there as well. So money that comes through the council and passes through to other governments.
I believe that also includes the HRA money that we receive.
Correct.
That passes through, which is a significant piece of that.
Yes. So the 2016 budget is about a 6% increase over our 2015 budget. The major areas are our labor costs, growing transit operations, including the opening of the A-line, and debt service increased by about $14 million. Just blowing apart the operations portion of that budget, the 692 slice, I wanted to just show you how much the salaries and benefits play into our budget. So about 60% of our operations budget is goes to our people who work and provide that service on the road. This next slide talks about those people. Our proposed 2016 budget has 4,309 FTEs. As you can see, most of those FTEs are in our transportation division, highly representative of our bus drivers as well as our maintenance staff. Increase over last year of about 1% in transportation that represents operators, maintenance, officers, related to opening up of the A-line as well as overhaul for the Hiawatha line. Environmental Services actually had a decrease of about 28 positions. Those were vacant positions through attrition that we then took out of the budget. And in Regional Administration, we've had an increase of administrative staff to support the growing operations across the organization. This next slide looks back again then at the total operating budget, $985 million, and how it divides by division. Transportation division is about 61% of our budget at $598 million. Environmental Services, 27%, Community Development, and then Regional Administration. The costs for Regional Administration are allocated out to the other divisions for the most part, and so a lot of the cost of Regional Administration is actually in the other budgets. This next pie chart shows where the funding comes from for our operating budget. Charges for services are the are one of the biggest sections. That's our fares and our wastewater fees. State revenues are the other largest source for us. Motor vehicle sales tax represents $279 million of that slice. We also get general fund appropriations for transit, $71 million. Parks, about $10 million. And then for housing, water supply, and I&I grants, about $7 million in those areas.
Mary, I'm just going to jump in real quick. So on the state revenues, when we talk about the motor vehicle sales tax, I know a number of you serve on the transportation committees, but for those who don't, that MVEST is demonstrates the 36% of the motor vehicle sales tax that was constitutionally dedicated.
Right.
And so 4% goes to Greater Minnesota Transit, 36% comes to metro area, and then 60% goes to MnDOT. So mm-hmm. I know the transportation chair is here, but just so folks know that, that is a that comes in to the council through a constitutional amendment.
The federal revenues represented by red on the chart here, about $87 million that are revenues that support our HRA, about $58 million there, 53 of which pass through the landlords, and transit operations about $28 million, and that's primarily preventative maintenance programs. Property taxes, $82 million there. About 2% of our property taxes support operations. The remainder support the livable community programs and our debt service. And we'll talk a little bit more about our levy on a next slide. So, as I said, our proposed property tax levy is $82 million, represents a 2% increase over the prior year. Property taxes are primarily used to pay debt service, and you'll see that by the green shaded areas. About 60% of our levy is related to debt service. The blue shaded areas represent our Livable Communities Act programs, and they represent about $16 million, or about 20%. And then our general purposes levy, $14 million, and again, that's about 2% of our operating budget. This next slide shows our Livable Communities grant programs. Again, those are funded by the property tax levy. And I just wanted to show, since the inception of that program, the number of grants that have been awarded and the amount of funds that have been awarded. These grants help to clean up polluted sites. That's the TIBRA grants, expand affordable housing opportunities, and build pedestrian-friendly, transit-oriented development. As I said, the program was begun in 1995, and since 1995, we've awarded $308 million. These grants leverage billions of dollars of private and other public funds.
And I'm just going to jump in one more time. So before session started last year, I provided each of the metro area legislators handouts for each of the different divisions within the council for transit, parks, wastewater, the HRA, and then livable community. So each of you should have a copy if you have it, or if you don't have it, I'm happy to provide it, that we are able to break down each of these investments by each of the Senate districts, also by each of your House districts. So if you're interested in trying to see what we have as far as ADA riders or Metro Mobility riders, the transit lines you have, the livable communities grants you've received, the wastewater investments that you have, or the regional parks that you have, or special park projects in your districts. I have that information, and I know at the beginning of session that's a busy time for folks, but I'm happy to provide that again if folks are interested in what it looks like within each of your districts as well. So just let me know.
This next slide tries to provide for you an estimate of the impact on the taxpayer of the council's property tax levy. And this is both the inside and outside of the transit tax and communities. Our livable communities levy, as well as our general purposes levy, goes across the entire seven county metro region, and our debt service levy for transit goes only inside the transit tax and communities, and that's the inside and the outside that this slide displays. Next slide gives a sense of size and scope in terms of where the metro area property tax dollar goes. By far, counties, cities, and school districts represent the largest part of the metro area tax dollar, and other special districts and the Metropolitan Council are a much smaller piece of that tax dollar, while still significant. Next slide here looks at the council's property tax levy in comparison with inflation, and as you can see, over the years, the council has been a good steward in comparison with inflation in holding the impact of our property tax levy as low as it is necessary to meet our funding needs. We're making a shift now into our capital program. The capital program proposed by the council is $8.1 billion. I will say that the capital program is a living document. Projects go into the program, are amended into the program, and as they're closed, they are removed from the program. So the authorized capital program represents those projects that have been authorized to move forward. And projects cannot be authorized by the council until funding sources are secured for them. As well, projects, as I said, are not removed until they are completely closed. So about 75% of the authorized capital program has already been spent, but since the project isn't closed, it still stays in the capital program. The six-year capital improvement plans at $3.9 billion are projects where we've identified a funding source but have not necessarily secured that funding source. So the full funding grant hasn't been awarded. We're on a different fiscal year than the state is, and so the state appropriations happen at a mid-year for us, and we would amend those into the authorized capital program once the funding is secured. The transitways, in particular the New Star light rail projects, have a big impact on our CIP. I wanted to show the capital program without the transitway programs in there, and that reduces our capital program down to $3.3 billion. And by far the largest portion then is focused on preservation. About 70% of the program is focusing on preserving our fleet system, preserving the infrastructure for the wastewater system and the park system. This next slide represents how the capital program is funded. And again, this is an $8.1 billion program. This represents both funding sources that have been secured and those that are just anticipated but not necessarily secured. The federal government plays a very large role, in particular with the federal New Starts program in the light rail system. So about $3.3 billion comes from the federal government, or about 41%. Council bonds also play a big role. About 25% of the program is funded through council bonds for wastewater, parks, and transit. CTIP, the County Transit Improvement Board, about $1.3 billion. The state has also been a funding partner in our projects, about 9% or about almost $1 billion. Local funding represents primarily the regional rail authorities, HCRA and RCRA, related to the light rail systems. And then PAYGO represents a small portion of the wastewater system that we use a pay-as-you-go rather than an issuing debts to support. As we look at all of these funding sources, the majority of these funding sources are related to transit that aren't geobonds. So the wastewater system is almost entirely funded through bonds and the wastewater fees to pay off those bonds, except for that very small portion of PAYGO. The park system gets both state geobonds and council bonds, and then the rest of those funding sources are all transit related.
And I'm just going to clarify, when we talk about the local piece, Mary mentioned HCRA and RCRA, and those are our terms for the Hennepin County Regional Rail Authority and the Ramsey County Regional Rail Authority. So just so folks are aware.
So the council has a AAA bond rating. We have about $1.5 billion outstanding, and this slide would be exactly as I would expect it when I told you from the last slide that all of those other funding sources related to transit, well, wastewater is a very large infrastructure, and it's, as I said, nearly entirely funded through our bond system. So $1.3 billion of the $1.5 billion in general obligation debt relates to the wastewater system. Transit about $208 million, and parks $12
million. So, Mr. Chair, that is the end of our overview for the committee, and happy to take any questions you may have or speak to what we can on other issues, and ready to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. I do have a couple preliminary questions, and I'm going to refer back to will be on your handout number 3, the metrics of the wastewater charge.
Right here.
There you go, right there. Obviously, you see a little bit of a departure from the trend line with regard to the green upwards, and I think Ms. Bogey spoke to an aging infrastructure. Where are we in the process? What do you anticipate going forward for, say, the next 3 to 5 years in terms of replacement of infrastructure? We not only have, in this context, the wastewater treatment centers, but at some point we're going to have to start talking about replacement of such things as, you know, rail and motorized vehicles that run on those rails, and what's the anticipation for the costing of those as well?
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, in the capital program, as you look in the book, as we get towards the later pages, you will see individual projects related to just the things that you're talking about. So in environmental service, you'll see a focus on interceptors and where they're going with interceptors over the next 6 years. In the transportation system, you'll see fleet replacement as a line in there, and you'll see over the next 6 years where those things are going. So we do have a fleet replacement plan. Part of that is driven by some federal requirements because they play a role in funding those fleet replacements. And we do also on the waste management side have projects for interceptors, for pipes, those kinds of projects listed in the project. And we look out 6 years in the capital program that the council adopts, but we have a much longer lookout in the individual departments for where we see our funding needs.
And specific to wastewater, I know Senator Osmek is familiar with this as well, since we had some water issues out in his area, but we have pursued funding for influent infiltration grants through the Capital Investment Committee and general obligation bonds in the past. Since those funds are GO bonds, they can only be used for public infrastructure. So we've also brought forward requests for funds out of the Clean Water Legacy funds that we're able to work with individual homeowners in the past to hopefully defray some of the costs of the replacement of those of their, their specific hookup to our interceptor pipes. And so there are a variety of ways that we are trying to address some of the water issues, and we made a recommendation again to the administration this year related to seeking some additional money through the bonding bill for INI as well, and the governor will take that under advisement when he brings forward his bill. When Ms. Bogie talks about the aging infrastructure, there is no doubt that that is happening, and so we're trying to find ways to not only help the municipalities and counties and cities and the council, but there's also a cost to the personal homeowner to that, and trying to find alternative ways than bonding to help them would be a good idea.
Mr. Chair, I will add from a chart from our division presentation, this goes out to about the year 2020, and we do expect that our outstanding debt for wastewater will be about $1.4 billion. And so that is growing. That also puts a strain on our debt service. When our debt service for environmental services gets kind of in that 45% of operations budget, we get concerned about that as well, and we look for other ways to manage through that. PAYGO is one of those ways. As we increase our PAYGO, we're able to relieve some of that pressure on the operating budget of debt service.
Just one follow-up then. I noticed on your slide about the metrics for ridership, you mentioned that commuter rail consumes about 1% of the 331,000 rides per day. But then on the slide where you're talking about the Metro Green Line, just wondering how you compare and contrast the numbers on that with the numbers in that pie chart. They don't seem to mesh.
Mr. Chair, the commuter rail and the Green Line is a light rail system.
All right. I just wanted to make sure I was thinking correctly. Thank you.
Commuter rail is the North Star system.
Right. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sort of along that line, some questions on the transit and transportation area. Looking at the FTEs, I guess that would be H2. Just a couple things I noticed. Central Corridor administration operations has about 216 people, and that compares with operations for Hiawatha at 64. FTE. So maybe there's just a different way of expressing what Central Corridor operations, amount to. But it looks like, nearly four times the FTEs.
Ms. Bogie?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm not sure that I have the details of why that difference is there. I will say that some of our maintenance are shared, staff are shared. I don't know if that has.
Representative Rumbeck, that's a great question, and unfortunately, our finance person from Metro Transit isn't here, but we'll follow up and send that answer to the whole committee. I mean, it looks like we need to have. We'll clarify that for everybody.
Okay, that'd be great. And Mr. Chair, then just to keep going, in the Metro Transit bus section of FTEs, also an interesting set of numbers. You have the Metropolitan MT training division dropping by half from 2012 to 2016, whereas the admin sort of doubles. So that just is interesting, and perhaps you could look into that as well. Also, the Metro Police, is a big increase, going from 93 to 137. So.
Yep, and Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, I can speak to some of the police. Is that since that time we have added the Green Line as well? So there was an increase there as well. But regarding the administration piece, I'm not quite sure what that was about. But under the operations piece that you mentioned before, again, that was linked to the Green Line as well. But we'll follow up on those questions and make sure that we get that back to the entire committee.
Okay.
Representative Rumbeck.
Going a few more questions then. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in noting sort of the text in the budget, and one of the divisional objectives for transportation is to grow transit ridership. And yet when you do look at the actual numbers, 2012 to 2016, you don't see tremendous growth in ridership. I think it's about 4 to 5% total, and that may exclude Metro Mobility and some of those, but in the transit area. And the fares are up, only 16% over 4 years. That's despite having Green Line come online. So those two situations would seem like, we're not really getting to the goals, transit ridership being the, I would think, the preeminent thing we're all about. How do we get to 10-20%?
Well, Madam Mr. Chair ridership. And Representative Rumbeck, I appreciate that. I know that we feel, and Ms. Bogie mentioned earlier, that the bus is a significant part of our overall transit ridership, and the bus system is one area that we have not had the legislature invest in as well over that past period of time. So we have experienced some growth over that period of time, but we have brought forward recommendations to invest in that area as well. And so we feel very happy about the growth that came along with the Green Line. And again, that happened here within just the past year and maybe 6 months, 4 months. But we would like to invest in the bus system more. We do believe that there is a lot of latent demand, and we have. When I brought forward the recommendation or our presentation to the transportation committees earlier this spring, we showed that over the past 10 years that the bus ridership has in fact grown over 14% over the past 10 years, with not much more than inflation being adjusted for in that budget. So we think that additional 4% is pretty good over that short period of time.
I have Representatives Nash, and then I have Representative Hornstein, and then Senator Dibble will be after him. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. Members, and to the testifiers, this is a question that I want to begin today. We're going to hopefully have some hearings in the new year on this, but I have a letter dated May 18th from CEO Lisa Moe from the Stewart Companies to Chair Dunick, copied several members of the legislature. The Stewart Companies, as I'm sure you're aware of, they're a land development company. They have many holdings along the proposed Southwest Light Rail line. They brought to your attention through Chair Dunick a concern that they had that if the proposed line could be moved, it would avoid several costly EISs and some mitigation of swamp lands, and it would actually adversely impact their land. They did some private engineering studies and showed that if you could move this station, this proposed station, to the east about a quarter of a mile, that the Met Council could save roughly $50 million of cost. And the letter is dated May 18th, 2015, and I did bring copies if folks would like to see that. To date, they have yet to get a response. To date, they haven't gotten a phone call, email, a return letter. They've copied myself. We've done some follow-up. And I'm just wondering, $50 million is kind of a lot of money, especially for the chief financial officer. That's a lot of dollars. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, speaking on behalf of my constituent and her company, that seems an awfully high price for indifference to not even respond with a letter saying, yes, we've received your letter, let alone begin a dialogue, which they haven't gotten either. So I'm curious if you could maybe begin doing some research as to why this indifference at such a high cost has happened, because I find that to be a little bit alarming.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I find that alarming as well. And so I will talk to our folks and find out, you know, if there was a response, if it wasn't received, if what happened. I can't sit here today and tell you what happened, but $50 million is a significant amount of money, and I take it very seriously as well. As you know, I come to the legislature seeking funding from the state to fund projects like this, and $50 million is in that case is an enormous amount of money. So I will follow up and find out what is going on, and Representative Nash, I'd love to have a copy of that letter as well. And when we wrap up this meeting today, I will have a conversation with our staff and figure out what's going on.
I do appreciate that, Mr. Shedden. It's, you know, again, $50 million is one of those eye-popping numbers that you sort of pay attention to when you're scanning your emails, so thank you.
I certainly do when I scan my emails, yes.
And just as a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if you wanted to work offline, I'd be happy to talk with you. I know Ms. Moe is very interested in engaging. Again, moving this to the east by a little bit certainly seems to save $50 million of Minnesota taxpayer money. So I would appreciate the dialogue.
Mr. Chair, absolutely, Representative Ashton. I'll be following up with you very soon.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up some of the questions Representative Runbeck was asking. Good questions about how to increase ridership on the system. And when you do this kind of budgeting or forecasting of ridership, do you take into consideration frequency of service, infrastructure such as bus shelters? Representative Runbeck, you've raised that question, which I agree with, improving and the shelter situation, the ridership experience, et cetera. It seems like if we make those kinds of investments, we might be able to get the kinds of increases that we're all looking for. So is that factored in? Because it seems to me, again, frequency of service and the comfort of the experience might be important. And I'm looking for the A line as it might give us some more concrete data on that, because those are the types of investments that you're doing on that. So is that factored in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, yes, it is factored in. And in fact, we did pursue a federal Ladders of Opportunity grant that included investment in bus shelters, which we are along the lines of incorporating that today. Also included in our funding bill that we brought forward was not just investment in transit ways, but it also involved investing in our bus system. And our plan was to build it, base bus ridership, not just Metro Transit, but for the suburban transit providers, Transit Link, all areas within the region, to try to build that by like 20% over, or 27% over the next 10 years. And then on top of that, we also were pursuing funding to invest in our shelters. I know many of you have seen the system before. Those of you who drive 35W today see the broken staircase that leads up to basically the Lake Street, which is ridiculous that is the type of facility we have there. And so in our long-range budgeting, that is what we're doing. But to see that in our long-range capital improvement program, and then in our annual operating program, we need to get those investments, and that's why we come to the legislature seeking those. And so we have to work together on that.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein, any follow-up?
No, thanks. That's helpful.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Chair. All right. My question is along the same line. Two points. One is, do you have any data? I mean, I think it's an excellent question, and what is it that we need to do to improve ridership on the kind of the basic core service, which is kind of the regular route scheduled bus service? And I'm wondering if you have any evidence or data or research that shows when and where we make those investments in this region, we can show better ridership. For example, before my time, I remember the legislature did deliver some funding increases to Metro Transit for the purpose of bus operations and paired that with a requirement that ridership increase on a more aggressive pace than had been planned. I'm wondering what resulted from that effort back in that time. We had more recently kind of the Mark II improvements, where mm-hmm. a significant improvement to bus service in and out of downtown along Marquette and 2nd Avenue.
Yep.
I'm wondering if that showed any results, if that can kind of give us a path or a guidepost and how we might think about bus service investments in the future and corresponding resources that are needed for that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I think looking back at the UPA Urban Partnership Agreement and the efforts that were made to really allow the bus system to flow through Marquette and 2nd Avenue, we should look at that. So I will make sure we do that. I can tell you that not only are we seeing efficiency as far as time that it takes to move through the downtown, and the time is for all providers. We have got the Shakopee system, we've got Prior Lake, whatever, MBTA, the Plymouth system, Maple Grove, the Metro Transit, all of those providers benefited and continue to benefit from that. So we can certainly find out what it means as far as time, but there's also financial savings that you're saving there as well, which is, I was just with Senator Wicklund yesterday in Bloomington talking about investments that need to be made at the Mall of America, because we have a stop, security stop there that costs every particular bus that goes through there 2 to 5 minutes, along with the fuel that goes along with that. And when you talk about 44 buses and 9 routes that are running through that facility every day over the course of a year, that adds up to a significant amount of time. And I'm willing to bet that with the Urban Partnership Agreement that all providers have experienced that. And I think that this probably attracted riders as well, because you're able to get in and out of downtown. Again, we've got 40% of the folks who work in downtown Minneapolis get there on one of the transit systems, either through rail or through the suburban transit providers or Metro Transit, and we anticipate that that's going to continue to grow. And so I appreciate the question, and let me take a look back and talk with our folks at MnDOT and see what we can come up with, because I'm certain, and I know I'm getting a little long-winded here, but the other thing that we're going to be able to see is with the A-Line. When that opens, that route runs basically from Rosedale down to Ford Parkway, so it'll connect at the Green Line there, take a right at the Ford Parkway, and connect to the Blue Line. Currently, we have a route that runs up and down that line. We anticipate with the investments that we're making with the A-Line that we're going to be able to cut, I believe it's almost 20 minutes off of that route. And so folks will be able to move much quicker, more efficiently, and that is what allows us to attract ridership. And so that is one of many of the investments that we're looking in the bus system. And if you'll give me one more minute, that is when we brought forward our transportation package last year. Of the 20 transit ways that we were bringing forward, 85% of them, or 17 of them, were bus investments in arterial BRT and highway BRT and regular BRT. So we see the bus system as really one of the major factors moving forward here in the region, because we get the efficiency of using current infrastructure on the roads and moving more people through those areas. So one last fact is that during rush hour, the bus system carries the equivalent of a lane and a half of traffic on 35W between Lakeville and downtown. And so if we can continue to invest in that and those types of services, we would be happy to do that and work with the legislature to continue to make that improvement. And that was done through the Urban Partnership Agreement as well.
Senator Dibble? Representative Hornstein, you need to follow up to that.
Very quick, Mr. Chair, thank you. And along Senator Dibble's line of questioning about the MARC II project and Urban Partnership Agreement, it reminded me about investments in park and ride facilities in suburban areas. And are you tracking, you know, how much data do you have over time in terms of the use of those facilities, increasing, decreasing, staying the same? And do you have areas where you feel that we need to increase the park and ride facilities, or are there some that are very underutilized that, right, you know, need to be phased out, that type of thing? Because it seems like that's really a key part of the infrastructure, especially in suburban communities.
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I can't speak specifically to each of the park and rides, but I can tell you I met with a former representative and former member of this commission, Commissioner Mary Liz Holberg, within the month. And what we talked about was worrying about when we pursue funds for the Orange Line, which is the service running up and down 35W throughout the day. She's concerned that we're going to run out of space in the Lakeville Park and Ride, which was built as part of the Urban Partnership Agreement, who she carried that along with the two of you. And so we know that that Lakeville Park and Ride is filling up. We know that there are capacity issues throughout the region, and we need to come back and try ways to find ways to fund that. And I can try to get an analysis of where we're at with our park and rides. We've presented that before in the past to the to the legislative committee. So I have a bunch of assignments to take away with me today, but this is great. This is great. We'd love to talk about it. So we're happy to see where we stand on that.
Right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shetton, thanks for convincing everyone in the room that our buses are so awesome that we don't need any more trains, right? We don't need to spend that money. We need more Southwest Light Rail money. That's fine with me. Recently in the mail, I think it was
Mr. Chair, I think I've been misquoted.
I think you'll have an opportunity to refute.
All right, just making sure in case somebody's taping this.
Yeah. I think it was late last week, or maybe it was even as early as Monday, we received in the mail a solicitation that the Met Council is looking for members. I think it's called an equity commission or equity something commission. Can you enlighten me on, is that the right terminology?
Equity commission. Mr. Chair, I think to speak to Representative Scott's questions, I'd prefer to probably have one of our policy members here to be able to speak to that, because that is definitely not in the area of the budget that I was prepared to speak to today. I do believe that we have an equity initiative that is being brought forward by the council, and that is being brought forward through our council members and the chair. So we'd be happy to come back and speak to that. But in the meantime, Representative Scott, let me follow up with you and let you know what that initiative is all about.
Mr. Chair, my concern was that is that tucked into, is the, you know, I'm assuming that these commission members are going to be paid something, and I was just concerned, I'm just wondering where in the budget we might find information on that commission.
Yep. And Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, Ms. Bogie tells me that it's not a paid or salaried or a...
Oh, shoot, my husband won't be applying then.
But we'll make room for him.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. My next questions have to do with your levy. And I noticed it went from, did you double the levy this year from what it was last year, the percentage? No?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bogie.
We had a 2% increase over the prior year.
A 2% increase. Okay.
Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you. And I see that there's $82 million in property taxes is the total amount that you levy, and then about 14% of that is the Livable Communities Demonstration Act.
That's correct.
Account, rather. And then I've got a printout of several of the projects that were given grants, and it seems like so many of these are privately held property, apartments being erected, and my concern is, you know, the people in Andover, in Northern Coon Rapids, they're paying in, they're part of their property taxes are going towards the levy that the Met Council has the authority to charge the taxpayers. And I'm just wondering why the people of Andover and Coon Rapids should pay for, you know, these different buildings being erected privately, mostly privately, in other areas of the city. There's one here for Hopkins for $1.3 million. There's one in Minneapolis for $1.4 million. And, you know, my family's also been in the rental business, the rental housing business, and no one's ever given us a grant to help us build something. Or I've got newspaper articles where, you know, they were given a, they were told that, you know, they weren't going to need subsidy, and they end up getting subsidy anyway, these private entities, and no one's ever bailed me out. So I'm just wondering, it's concerning to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I can't speak to these specific grants. We do have members of our Livable Communities Advisory Committee who make these recommendations as well. I can certainly follow up with you and let you know who the members of that advisory commission is as well. I also don't know if anyone from Coon Rapids or Andover or up in that area had potentially applied for a grant. We can certainly find that out in the information I spoke to earlier. It goes back to show all the investments that would have been made in your district over that period of time. The legislature, through statutory authority, provides the council levy for these programs and move those funds out. So we operate under the statutory authorities that are provided to us, but I can't speak to exactly what the why the recommendations were made for those projects, and nor can I speak to the what projects had applied for those. But I can find out and let you know who's on that commission.
Mr. Shutton, I think what might be appropriate in the time we've got remaining is if Representative Scott could provide you with that list that she's providing and have you respond to her with the rationale for those grants offered.
No. Mr. Chair, I will also say that we do not make grants directly to private companies. All of these grants go to cities, counties, local governments, and to do these projects.
Representative Scott.
Thank you for that comment, but it goes without saying that the buildings that are being built are privately owned, and so they're being helped out and, by these grants.
Yep, and Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I think particularly like the tax-based revitalization account, what that program does is to take brownfield areas that have pollution on them, and the whole idea is to clean those up and turn them back into greenfields where development can take place, so they go back on the tax rolls, where over the course of time the city is actually collecting revenue on that, and these funds are to help cities in order to make sure that they're able to clean up that, you know, that blight and be able to allow that property to be used again in a way where it's creating a property tax base for those cities. So you know, we see that as a very important and very positive reason to want to invest in these. So that's exactly where the tax-based revitalization account monies go.
Right. Thank you. That's that account. I was really referring more to the Livable Communities Demonstration Account. And another concern, obviously, is that if you're raising the tax levy and these monies are going to these private individuals, you know, is that causing cities and counties to have to cut back in other areas for policing or other expenditures that they have? And that to me is a higher priority than, you know, a public-private partnership.
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, again, the cities would come forward with these requests, so I can't speak to how they look at this in their broader budgeting, but oftentimes the monies that we're able to provide are funds that allow them to complete a project, and so I think that they would see this as a benefit to their cities to be able to allow those projects to move forward and work with whoever they're working on to bring forward those projects. But that, again, when you speak to the municipal budgets and how that's going, that would be a question that I would ask of the cities that are making these requests.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions on just two quick topics, and I think the first one I'll touch on is one that Mr. Shetman already got me some information on, and that was around salaries and benefits. You've highlighted that over 50% of your operating budget is that, but I also noticed that you've increased FTE by 1.25%, somewhere around there, but your wage increase has gone up 6%. Can you give me a sense of how much of the wage increase is to new employees and how much is in, let's call it, annual merit? And the reason I ask the question is somewhat from an optic standpoint, in that we've seen wage growth about 1%. We're seeing companies, private companies, increase wages 1-2% on an annual basis. So this was a number that kind of popped out at me.
Mr. Shetman or Ms. Bogie?
Representative Albright or Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I'll let Ms. Bogie get into the detail on that. But the council, we are our staff by over 13 labor unions. So we are constantly in the process of negotiating those contracts, which sometimes those contracts are, you know, 1 year, 2 year, however that goes. So it is, we are, as you can see, a very big organization and have many representative units that we operate with. So it is, it's always in motion as we are bringing these forward. But I'll let Ms. Bogie speak to the detail on that.
Ms. Bogie.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I don't have before me today the breakout between the first part of your question, between what is representative of new staff versus existing staff. But as Judd said, we do have labor unions that we negotiate with, and so much of this increase is driven by what's in those union contracts, whether it be a step system in a salary grid or what is negotiated at the bargaining table for that. When we put together our budget, we look kind of at a total compensation picture in terms of where we project the budget, and so that is representative of that change. And then all of the positions that are in the system, what benefit package they're choosing, all goes into kind of that total salary picture. The question that you had asked that I provided you earlier information on was how does it break out between mm-hmm. wages and benefits, and that's not really the way we budget, so it took me a while to kind of say this is what would be what the pieces of that are. We look more at a total compensation as we're putting the budget together.
Well,
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, because I actually saw that you had a decrease in benefits due to being self-insured, that you were able to pass some of that savings along to your employees. So I thought that was a positive.
We're very proud of that, by the way.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I wouldn't say that we had a decrease in the benefits as much as people make different selection choices. And so whether it be single family or whether it be between the plans that we have a high deductible plan as well as a more robust plan, I would just put it that way. And so it's cheaper for the council when they select the high deductible plan. The employee and the employer pay a little bit more when they select the other plans. And so we did have some movement in that. While our premium rates stayed the same, total premium, the mix changed a little bit. And yes, we did have some savings there. We are having great experience so far with our self-insured program. But we're young in our self-insured program. We're in our third year, but our experience so far has been very good.
Oh, you're bucking the trend.
Yep. Follow-up, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, I noticed significant increases in consulting. And, Mr. Shetman, I know I'd asked you about that, and maybe I asked for a lot of detail, but maybe at a high level, a 13% increase in consulting from 14 to 15, another 13% increase from 15 to 16. Can you give us a sense of why we're seeing such large increases in consulting fees?
Mr. Shetman or Ms. Bogie?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would have to do a little bit more research on that. I wasn't clear on what the question you were asking there, as you asked for some detail.
Sure.
If we're looking at just where the increases are, I will go back and do some research.
Well, I think I asked for more than that. I'd like to know what types of consultants and how we're utilizing them. But I think that was originally just kind of trying to understand all of your consultant engagements really came from more of seeing the large increases. And we're talking, you know, $53 million. I mean, that's a significant amount of your budget.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Shaw,
just so folks know, Senator Pratt's office contacted me yesterday afternoon with a few questions, and we were able to provide a couple of the questions, and I did speak to his staff and then him prior to the meeting, saying that we just need to understand the question a little bit more, because what he was, the way the question was asked, it led to a lot of us having to interpret it, and so we just wanted to talk to Senator Pratt about that a little bit more, and we will follow up with him to be able to provide that information. But we are all about customer service here, so we want to make sure that we do follow up and provide the specific information he's looking for.
Thank you.
And I will add just a little bit to that. The line in our budget is actually consulting and contractual services, and there is a wide mix of things that go in there, including our software maintenance and license agreements. And so when you ask your question, I'm wondering, gosh, are you looking for clear consulting, or are you looking for all those other things that go in there? So we'll definitely be able to provide a breakout of that as I learn more about what you're looking for.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And, Mr. Chair, if the committee is interested in that, we can certainly pass that along, or else we'll just ship it over to Senator Pratt.
I think that would be appreciable by all the members to receive that once it's compiled by you. Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for either of you, Ms. Boogie or Mr. Shatman. On page 10 of the proposed operating budget, the sources of funds, I see there's an entry, and it's the smallest one in there, but it gives me the biggest interest, where it says that there's $24 million coming from the reserves. Can you expand on that a little bit? And does that encumber the reserves at all, or is that something that was unanticipated? And how did that come about? It's page 10, not on ridership.
We just go through until you get to the sources of operating is later. Actually, a very easy explanation for that. That is a planned use of reserves. As part of our revenue allocation policy for the motor vehicle sales tax and for the transit-related appropriation, we work with a revenue allocation policy with the suburban transit providers and the Metro Transit and Transportation Services funds. And so as a part of that policy or that procedure, we set some minimum and maximum reserves for each of those operating units. And part of the revenue allocation policy says first spend down the reserves to minimum, then apply the allocation to the budget to cover costs, and then rebuild reserves if there's anything left after that. And so that is a planned spend down of reserves as a part of that policy. I will also say that when we budget our motor vehicle sales tax, we budget 95% of the state sales or state forecast for the current year, and then anything that was above that from the prior year, we take from reserves and put into the budget. So rather than banking on the forecast is true for sure, we make sure by budgeting 95% and then taking from anything above that goes into the next year's budget.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, we've been doing that for years, as I'm sure you know. You appreciate and will recall, and with Senator Dibble and Representative Hornstein, will recall from the Transportation Committee that that in previous years the motor vehicle sales tax receipts were always coming in lower than forecast. So rather than getting burned, we were budgeting that 95% to be able to allow a little bit of room to make sure that we were able to move forward with that year's operating budget without creating a hole. And so by reserving that and bringing it into the next year's budget, that just allows us some continuity without having issues with cliffs happening if the or operating issues occur if the motor vehicle sales tax happens to drop, which for the longest time it kept dropping and dropping and dropping.
Senator Carlson?
Jim. Yeah, Mr. Shetland. So that's actually excess reserves.
Mr. Okay. Shutton?
No,
not excess reserve.
It's, Mr.
But it is a planned use of.
Yes.
Right. I would not call it excess reserves in any way. It's assuring that we can apply the total amount to the budget. So And it's simply applying the policy of bringing reserves down to a minimum. We would recommend higher than the minimum, of course, for both us and for the suburban transit providers, but the way we apply the policy is first to draw them down and then build them back up. Also, a little bit of that reserve use is from our OPEB funding. We are fully funded for our other post-employment benefits for both environmental services as well as regional administration and very close for Metro Transit. And so for our employee health care costs for retirees who are eligible in those divisions, we pull from our reserve fund for other post-employment benefits. Metro Transit is still funding theirs for the future, but they are also very close to being fully funded.
Senator Carlson?
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Runbeck, you had a follow-up?
I do, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the discussion really on, you know, long-range planning for transit. But in looking at, I think this comes out of the guideways, the current guideways book, but, you know, the bus situation, and apparently it's on pace this year to be its lowest ridership since 2005. So, you know, I'm curious to know if that is part of the long-range plan, if that is because of the way the routes intersect with light rail and so on. But, I mean, I guess I'll go to my bigger question, which is, I mean, looking at what the Transportation Division is said to do in this budget is to provide transit planning. Where is that long-range planning document? Where is that vision articulated, you know, in terms of the mix, the modal mix, the optimal, complement of all the different mixes, and is your plan the same as CTIB's long-range planning plan?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a great need to see and to look at the cost efficiency of, you know, bus costs per unit of capacity per year versus BRT, yep, versus LRT versus, you know what I mean?
Yep. I do know.
And
what
I don't
mean.
Know if we've seen that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, just to address a few of your questions, the council brings forward, as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, we are required federally to bring forward the Transportation Policy Plan. We do that every 4 years. And in that plan, we talk about the growth in our entire transit system, bus and rail, and for all providers, including Metro Mobility, the suburban transit providers, TransitLink. Also, we have we do work with CTIB. It is important to recall that CTIB specifically is funds and is our partner on funding transitways, where the council is specifically or has much broader roles, where we actually own and operate and fund the bus system. So they're, yes, they do complement each other, but they're not the same. And so that quarter cent that is collected by the sales tax, or excuse me, by CTIB counties, go into the expansion and operating of the current transitway system. Your question about ridership, one thing that we have found is that with the reduction of the fuel pricing, that we have seen a bit of a dip in the ridership as well. But we also see that trend continuing to grow because we know that the region is growing as well, and so as the region gets bigger, there will be more demand on that transit system. We also have noticed that with weather that people are able to drive as well. Generally, we are have had a few more days, particularly if you look at the North Star line and some of our of our other system, that folks will gravitate toward that service when there is an event, a weather event as well. And so all of those things, but in particular and most heavily influenced here is the price of fuel.
Mr. Chair, just to follow
Representative
up.
Representative Runbeck.
Okay, so this is new to me. I didn't know there was an every 4 year sort of big picture plan.
It's heavily required.
And where is that available to view, and when is the next one being prepared
Mr.
for release?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, we did bring this forward last year to the subcommittee. We also talked about it last year at the at the Oversight Commission as well. But we, the other thing I wanted to add is that we prepare through statute a guideway investment plan, which was put into effect, and some of you may recall, back in the 2011 legislative session. And so that program talks specifically about all of those transit ways that you were referencing with BRT, ABRT. And so we can tell you that product, and I can provide it to you, and I can also provide you a copy of the transportation policy plan, talks specifically about the costs, the capital operating costs, and the annualized year of service beginning.
Yeah, I'm
so
familiar
all of
with
that information
it's a great document.
We
yeah.
have it. And so that yeah. influences what is included in the transportation policy plan, which we have done for decades. And so
Mr. Chair and Mr. Shumman, does it look at the between bus, BRT, LRT, do we get down to the real number of what is the unit cost, the cost per unit per capacity for a year, you know, out the whole length of the life cycle of each vehicle and each system? Do we know that number, those numbers, and comparative numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, I know it speaks to many of those, but we've gravitated a little bit away from the unified operating and capital budget. So I would prefer to have the folks who write that document come and be able to speak to that. But they are able to speak to the costs estimated at that point in time into the future. But now as we look at different projects, when you get to different levels of engineering, and it looks like we're going to have a new federal transportation bill here soon, so that will influence how we feel about the about where the federal monies are coming from. All of those will influence how those transitways in particular are looked at, because they do look at the capital funding, but they also look at the operating funding and how that is administered and anticipated to be administered through the legislature. And and we come back and we update that, just like the legislature is a kind of a living, breathing organism. We have to do the same thing based on each of the actions that the legislature takes, particularly in operating budgets and in capital investments. So I can provide you both of those, the most recent copies of both of those. But rest assured, we do have that document, and the federal government requires it, and it is a heavy lift. That's why it's required every 4 years.
Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a clarification, Mr. Shetland. Last session, I had asked a question to the Met Council chair regarding funding, and I'm referring to page 626 of the unified budget. It shows the build-out cost, it appears to me, to build-out cost of Southwest Light Rail. I'd ask the chair, is it his intent that if the legislature, through its authority, does not provide the 10% required state match, that the project wouldn't go forward? And he said, correct, the project wouldn't go forward, and then you corrected him. And he said there was a correction made right at the desk that maybe it would. And now during the summer, I think he's made a statement that he would come to the legislature and request it, and if it didn't, I think there's a fuzzy area looking at that page. It sort of looks to me like they're going forward with or without the match. Can you clarify, you know, page 26 has a funding rollout of Southwest from 2016 to 2021. Is it the position of Met Council that they're going to get the 10% and it's not going forward, or what other methods is the Met Council going to do to fill that if we do not fill that in this legislative session?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmak, what you see in the capital program summary shows what is planned. And again, as Ms. Bogie mentioned earlier, when we bring this forward, we bring projects in and we bring projects out. But in this capital budget, it is planned. I don't want to get in front of the legislature next year, and you're correct that that Chair Dunnick sent forward a letter last summer saying that we will be working with the legislature to fund the final 10% of the project. But that is what you're asking me is a policymaker question that I will allow the policymakers to speak to that. But I can again share your comments with them as well. But I feel confident that we will have a many conversations about this, possibly before session, heading into session, and with many of the folks in this room. So I look forward to it.
Senator Osmond.
Nope, I will leave it at that. I just wanted to see if there was anything, seeing as you so delicately said the tape is rolling, that if there was anything that we could get on tape saying that yes or no or maybe or in between or what the case might be on what we're going to do with that 10%. I know Senator Dibble is going to be interested in moving that forward this next legislative session, but if there was something I could glean off early, it would be nice. So thank you. That's all I had.
I have Representative Nelson, then Senator Dibble.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question, I just have a request that the additional information that he's providing to individual members, if the whole committee can get that information so we can see, so we're all up to speed on the same things.
Representative Nelson, I'm assuring everyone on the committee that I think it's the shared trust that both people at the testifiers table will share that with the committee through my office, and I'm happy to provide it to you as soon as it gets to my desk. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, I'm interested in the questions that Representative Scott was asking about the Livable Communities Development Account. I just want to make sure that we have a fullness of understanding of what exactly those dollars go to pay for.
Yep.
You know, whether they pay for just the public realm infrastructure investments or they go into, you know, building actual private structures or not.
Mr. Shetland.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I appreciate that. I actually have the 2014 report to the legislature of the Livable Communities program, and I can provide that to the committee as well. We are required by statute to provide an update to the legislature, and so I can make sure that that is provided. And if we need to delve down into deeper detail after that, we're always happy to do that. Or if you're interested, Mr. Chair and members, to have us come give a presentation specifically on the Livable Communities program, that would be great. We'd love to do it and make sure that folks understand exactly what that program's, you know, charter is, what we're doing with it, and how we're approaching it. Because clearly there have been some questions about it, and if that's a future topic, we'd love to take you up on that and have that conversation. But in the meantime, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'll be providing that to everyone.
Senator Dibble.
That's it.
Any follow-up?
Yep.
I have Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a section on farebox issues. It appeared that in the appendices that there's some capital expenditures regarding farebox system, and I'm curious if there's anything new afoot in terms of that. And tying that in, it looks like Southwest Light Rail is expected to have a 40% farebox recovery, and that's, you know, significantly higher than Central or a Hiawatha.
No,
well, I think they're at 26 and 30%. So, I mean, is there something new we need to understand about Southwest?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I believe that the farebox recovery of both Hiawatha or the Blue Line and the Green Line are higher than that. I will certainly follow up with you on that. I think, I'm probably speaking out of turn here with our Metro Transit folks, but the farebox piece, the capital piece, is what you will see when you ride the bus or take the train. You are able to use the go-to cards, which allow passengers to board the vehicles quicker, and it allows us to speed up the system as well. And so what I am assuming, and I can't tell you this for sure, that it most likely is related to the ongoing either expansion or maintenance related to those machines, which look like the little footballs on the thing. I know Senator Dibble and Representative Hornstein take transit regularly and are familiar with those, and there is an ease. Oftentimes, with the with the suburban providers or the suburban routes that are used. You will see the folks that are heading out to Blaine or Shakopee or Lakeville or whatever, Maple Grove. When the folks get on the bus versus having to get out your change and put it into the bill collector, you're able to take your stored value or your go-to card or your ID and touch that box, and that moves you onto the bus or train much, much quicker without people digging in their pockets trying to find the correct change. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
We'll do it.
Mr. Shetland, I have just a couple follow-on questions. In one of the, I don't recall the page, and I can follow up with you, but it notes that your investment earnings actually languished a bit a couple years ago, and now they've recovered. That maybe not be the question I'm going to pose to you per se, but under your operating capital, you actually show a loss of about 2.2% from year over year. I'm just curious where that's coming from 2015 to 2016.
Mr. Chair, is there a particular page you're referencing?
It may be better if we work this number offline, just okay, so that we can sit side by side with it.
Great. That'd be great.
But in a larger context, I guess some of the numbers that I'm looking at go to the questions of matrix or metrics that you use in terms of evaluating performance for the various systems that you're responsible to. And I'm just wondering if you adhere or utilize any of the return on equity, the debt to revenue ratios that not trying to make a comparable assessment here between a private and a public entity, but are you using any of those types of metrics to evaluate the systems, and are you using those in judging the viability of systems in terms of where your emphasis should be placed going forward?
Mr. Chair, committee members, most certainly we're using methodology that looks both at the capital investment and then the operating tails that come along with that. We're looking at ridership and what kind of ridership we're expecting related to that, that ridership and the impacts of fuel prices that might have on that ridership. So most certainly we're doing a number of return on investment type of rigorous analysis of each of these projects. As it relates specifically to the New Starts program, the federal government has a very strenuous package that we need to put together for them to show that a line is viable. So absolutely we do that kind of work. In terms of our investment program, we look at our portfolio and how it's invested, and we compare to indices that are in the same type of short-term indices that other entities would use to track their performance. We have a very limited number of things that we can invest in by statute, and so we're investing in very, good, safe things. Much like the rest of the industry, we're earning very, very little in particular on our short-term investments and a little better on our long-term investments. Our other post-employment, we have about $200 million in our reserve there that's invested with the State Board of Investment. And those are more like pensions, so they're invested, and we compare those to the S&P because they're very long-term equity-type investments related to that program. So absolutely we're doing that kind of analysis and on our projects as well as how we do business at the council.
I think just the reason I asked the question is more to the point of, I think those types of analyses, they may transfer over in more of a policy, conversation, which I have a desire to, reintroduce, sometime in January as we move closer to the beginning of session. But I think they're fair questions to ask in the context of looking at your budget, because that's how it's constructed, is based upon a fair return or a fair response to the taxes, the revenue that's generated by the user fees and what have you that are provided to your organization. So I think using those as an assessment going forward for this commission as well as for the subcommittee and the other committees that respond to your budget for
and for your requests. I think they're an integral piece of assessing whether or not there's virtue in some of the programs in support of them going forward. So, concluding remarks from either one of you.
I just have to thank you, Mr. Chair, and I mentioned earlier to Representative Rumbeck that we talked about the transportation policy plan in the subcommittee. I meant in the transportation committee, so I apologize for that. I think I had that wrong. Been bugging me ever since I said it, so I just wanted to make sure that I had that correct. But Mr. Chair and members, thank you again for the opportunity for us to come up here. I am sincere in saying that we'd love to have you come visit some of our facilities, understand the operating world that we live in. As you know, transportation is a huge part of this, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about wastewater as well. So if the commission's interested in us showing you around a little bit, we'd love to do it. And again, I'm serious about coming back and having a broader conversation about livable communities as well, if the committee's interested. But I hope everybody has happy holidays, and I'll be following up with everyone with all of these requests. So I know that we've had folks taking great notes, so it'll take me a little while to get this together, but we will certainly follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schutten and Ms. Bogie, for attending. I appreciate your indulgence for some of the questions. I think some of them go to the point of probably our follow-up meeting in January, where it's our intention to delve in greater detail into the policy, the vision that your organization has for the metro counties that are involved in the Met Council. And so I would say that we should come prepared as a committee probably in January for a somewhat lengthier conversation about, in particular, Thrive 2040, where that takes us over the next several years. As we've shared with a number of the committee members, and they've shared with me, as Senator Carlson and I spoke yesterday, I think there is not an appetite, but a desire to provide for a greater level of accountability and transparency, and that speaks to governance. And so we'll be undertaking that conversation here after the first of the year. So, members, thank you for your attendance today, and with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.